Hello, everybody. Yes, I'm dressed. It's funny. I'm not in the studio because, well, first of all, it's freezing out and we wanted to warm up by the fire, but and maybe with a little bit of mezcal to help us. But it's also time once again for the best of, kind of a quirk of the calendar. Our best of 2021 is hitting on January 2nd, the best of 2021 and the first of 2022. But we have put together, thanks to Jason Howell, our producer, and all of you and your suggestions, some of the best moments from 2021 coming up next.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, episode 856, for Sunday, January 2nd, 2022. The year's best. This episode of This Week in Tech is brought to you by Podium. Join more than 100,000 businesses that already use Podium to streamline their customer interactions. Get started free at podium.com/TWiT or sign up for a paid Podium account and get a free credit card reader. Restrictions apply. And by Nareva. Traditional audio conferencing systems can entail lots of components. Installation can take days, and you might not get the mic coverage you need. That's complex, expensive. But Nareva Audio is easy to install and manage. No technicians required. And you get full room coverage. That's easy, economical. Learn more at Nareva.com. And by Blue Land. Single-use plastic is so year 2000. Thing is, it's 2022, baby, which means it's way past time to make cleaning fun, beautiful, and plastic-free. Right now, you can get 20% off your first order when you go to blueland.com/twit. And by Imperfect Foods. Imperfect Foods is catching the food that's falling through the cracks of our food system by sourcing quirky yet delicious foods. Right now, Imperfect Foods is offering our listeners 20% off your first four orders when you go to imperfectfoods.com and use the promo code TWIT. Hello, everybody. Time once again for the show. We cover the week's tech news with some of the biggest journalists in the business. Although, as you can see, I'm all alone. There are no journalists to help. And really, it's not the week's, but the year's biggest tech news. It's our annual year-end edition of This Week in Tech. And actually, it's a good way to begin a new year. Here we are in 2022. 2021 was a piece of work. A piece of work. We didn't know what it was going to be like. We still don't know, frankly, what 2022 is going to be like. But I think at the beginning of 2021, we were kind of getting ready for the roaring 20s. Our standards have really changed for what we consider entertainment during all of this. It's like, oh, I'll just watch somebody in his living room. I'm in my living room. You're in your living room.
Although I got to say, some of the best music has come out during the pandemic of people just recording in their homes, covering a song, and then releasing the video, you know, just them playing it on the internet. There's a bunch of really excellent music out there as a result of this. And you got to wonder how that's going to change the music business, you know, once we get come out of this.
It's one of my favorite topics is what's going to persist and what's not going to persist. For instance, Weirdly, last year, hardcover book sales were up 18%. So I don't think that's going to continue. I think that's like that's because of the pandemic. That's a blip. Audiobooks also up, I think, 16%. And ebooks, which have been dying, they've been down every year for the last few years, were up as well in the double-digit percentage. But none of those trends, I think, will continue. On the other hand, streaming services gained about 50% overall in customers. And that, I think, is going to hasten the end of cable television and it's going to really move us to the over-the-top world that we've been slowly moving to. It's going to hasten it. So it's interesting. In some cases, the pandemic makes changes that won't last. But I think things like Zoom will continue for a long time. I think
streaming television. I mean, Disney Plus had a huge year because of it.
Well, I got to say, usually on New Year's Eve, my wife and I will go out clubbing or raving, as I believe it's known in the year. And so 3 years ago, for example, we were watching one of our favorite bands in Glasgow. And it was a great night out. And this year they did a paid stream. We listened to it at home. I didn't have anyone lecture on the wife. I could have a cup of tea when I wanted to. It was actually a pretty good night. You miss the energy of a club, but I think those kind of streaming services are really going to take off.
Well, that's what I wonder. I mean, there are certain in-person things we do, like conferences and concerts. I have to imagine that live performers are suffering mightily because of this. And will they come back? They say that the 1920s, the Roaring Twenties, was part of the reason it was the Roaring Twenties is because people were so burned out from the pandemic of 1918 and being quarantined and masked for so long that when they finally came out, it was the Roaring Twenties. Do you think we'll have our own Roaring Twenties? You think so, Dwayne?
Yes, 100%. Without a doubt. There's a book I've been recommending. Pale Rider, which is about the Spanish flu pandemic. And in it, they talk about kind of the changes in society as a result of that. And yeah, I think we're just going to have an explosion of people traveling, going to parties, concerts. I think every band in the world that's a name will get out and tour. I mean, I think it's going to be almost like a frantic golden age when this is all done.
Oh, I hope you're right.
Because if you look on social media, like all of my friends on Facebook and Instagram, all they talk about is when this is over, here's where I'm going. You know, and they post pictures of countries they've been to that they love.
It's what we fantasize. What my wife and I fantasize about practically every night is where do you want to go first? What do you want to do first? Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And remember, the Roaring Twenties wasn't just about people going out and partying. It was people changing what they've come to expect from society. You know, after such a prolonged time of not being able to do what you want to do, suddenly you're changing how you consume. You're changing what you consider to be success. You're changing what you consider to be stable employment or stable housing. We could do the same thing. And if you do that, the companies that latch onto that and start feeding that appetite, they're going to make a mint. It's going to be a free for all once the dam breaks.
And that's mostly analog, you think? Analog companies.
Experiences companies.
Yeah. Physical experience. I mean, the one comment I'm getting again on social media is when this is over, so many people are going to get hugs because you know no one has been able to hug everyone else. No one's been able to go visit anyone else.
Why stop at hugging? Let's just all rip off our clothes. You know, there's going to be a massive baby boom.
Yes.
9 months after this ends.
Yeah.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Lots of French kissing.
Yeah. I think if we really want the Roaring 2020s to duplicate the 1920s, we should ban alcohol as well. Let's just do that, too.
Let's just repeat it.
Let's just repeat the whole thing. Now, we remember how it ended with the Great Depression, so maybe we could skip that part. But the
prohibition of alcohol did have a huge social influence on the United States because men and women started drinking together for the first time, for example.
Right.
Different races started mixing together.
Oh, that's a good point.
So, I mean, it was an enormous social driver, albeit an incredibly stupid policy. But, you know, I mean, it was an enormous driver for social change. And you saw women's headlines going up and they started smoking. And, okay, so it wasn't all good. But, I mean, you know, men and women mixed a lot.
I might start smoking. I might next year. If I survive.
It took me years to give it up. I'm never taking this.
This week in smoking.
No, I promise. I am not going to start smoking.
You say that. I applied for a job in a magazine in the 1990s, and they had a cigar reviewer, and that was his job.
What a great job.
He reviewed cigars.
Oh, what a great job. Let me start with you, Alex. Is meme stock, it's a little bit of a put down. Like, these people aren't real investors. This is just a meme. Is that a fair characterization?
I don't think it's as pejorative as we might think on the surface. I think it's almost one of those negative things you kind of take on as a joke that you then begin to enjoy yourself. So meme stock to me just describes the group of stocks that are trading not based on fundamentals or long-term value, but based on kind of current market sentiment amongst the retail crowd. So,
and by AMC, the way, the sentiment may not be driven either by market fundamentals. It may be driven, and it seems to be somewhat driven by, let's screw the hedge funds, right?
Yeah. There's a lot of annoyance amongst retail traders about their position in the market. If you have a lot of money, you have access to better information, better tools, and faster trades. If you're a retail investor like, you know, us here, kind of regular folks, you don't. And so it feels like the market is a little bit set up against you, and it is. And so what you're seeing here is a combination of greed, social interest, kind of people banding together on the internet to bring something together, and also annoyance with the way things are set up. And I think a lot of people are still pretty peeved about 2008, 2009 and how things kind of worked out there and how people didn't go to jail and how we, the taxpayers, spent a lot of money to keep these big banks alive. And so when these social traders on Reddit and other places notice that GameStop is shorted more than 100%.
140%. So I don't even know how that can happen. By the way, that's a failure of regulation. But the hedge funds have bought more GameStop stock than exists.
And sold it short. And so people knew that if they took advantage of this,
they could
ran
never
the price of it up,
make it good, right? There's not enough stock to buy.
How
it's
did
been
they
one of the most
know
interesting things.
How did they know that it had been shorted 140%? Somebody must really, someone sophisticated must have looked at that and figured it out. No?
So Philip, the short interest is periodically available. Before this show, I was Googling around a little bit, and you can find data on that. And with more sophisticated tooling like a Bloomberg terminal, you can definitely find out. But what's really interesting, and you raise a good point,
by the way, that some people characterize this as 4chan with a Bloomberg terminal.
Which is exactly what it is. Which is exactly what it is.
Well, but wait a minute. Now, I got to point out. And by the way, Elizabeth Warren, AOC, and others in Congress have called for an investigation. The SEC, which moves like molasses, woke up late last week and went, wait a minute. I got to point out, it is not obvious. You know, this is the superficial description of this. But it's completely possible that it wasn't just retail traders, that maybe other hedge funds were intentionally short-squeezing their competition. We don't know exactly
what's
really going on here, do we?
No, I mean, I think that what happened, you know, when the squeeze started and when you did have people like Roaring Kitty and some of the other big Wall Street
– Roaring Kitty is deep effing values.
Yeah.
It's his YouTube handle.
We'll
call him
YouTube name,
Roaring Kitty from now on. That's probably more
right. Yeah. So when you have this guy who's, you know, turned a $50,000 investment into $31 million or whatever, and he's – he's incredibly clever and incredibly smart. When you have people like him who made those moves, I do think that those were people who saw a glitch, a hole in the system, and were able to take advantage and then were able to propel this into other things. The thing is, though, is that once the stock started rising and once everybody started kind of staring at it like slackjawed, what's happening, and it went up and up and up, obviously you're going to have like non-retail investors who are interested in it too, right? Like, so I think that it becomes at that point, you know, people who are doing high frequency trading and who are trading based on, you know, having, you know, watch lists and algorithms and are doing all the ways that, you know, most professionals trade now, which is not the way that retail investors trade, we're obviously going to be getting in on it. And I wouldn't be surprised if, and this is usually not uncommon, where some of the hedge funds will have a position to backstop against like their short position failing, right? So I don't think we know exactly what it is. I'd be very curious to hear Alex's thoughts. My thoughts, just based on what we know now, and so much of it we're still figuring out, as he said, the news cycle has moved so quick. But my gut tells me that while most of the interest has been led by retail investors, once things shifted past a certain point, then you did start to see traditional investors, whether they be hedge funds or high frequency traders or whatever, starting to get in on the action too, which is only going to continue to keep this frothy. I expected the crash to have already happened. I was very clearly wrong on that, but I think this is one of those things where we're all expecting the inevitable crash. We don't know when the bottom's going to drop, but the completely nutso thing about this is that we don't know how high this is going to go until things presumably regulate themselves, assuming they do. And maybe this is one of those weird things where it won't. I think that GameStop as a company is in such a poor position that I don't see how it can continue to, you know, stay at these levels. But yeah, to your point, I don't think it's definitely, I think that it started and was largely led by retail investors. But if people are making money in this, like the game is rigged. It is. I mean, I think anybody who's followed anything and has anything to do with finance understands and like accepts that you can't expect the billionaires to be sitting on the sidelines and seeing regular people making money and not wanting to get in on some of the play too. I mean,
it's just bizarre. Roaring Kitty. And this is what you do on Wall Street Bets. You post pictures of your, you know, losses and your gains and so forth. He posted, and nobody can verify this, but he claims he invested $53,000 and at some point it reached $48 million. Whether he sold, I don't think, because I think he's saying hold, which I think, Alex, is nuts, because isn't this bubble going to pop at some point? Here's a picture of a kid, 10-year-old Jaden Carr. His mom gave him 10 shares in GameStop in 2019 as a Kwanzaa present.
That's amazing.
He's happy.
Amazing. Love him. Love, love, love. I genuinely love that for him.
She wanted to teach him about investing, but what lesson did Jaden learn, really, about investing? That's one of the concerns I have. I see people like my own son, naive investors, who say, oh, you know, I'm going to get me that Robinhood, and I'm going to put some money in here because this is a great opportunity. But what do you think, Alex? Is the bubble about to burst? I guess it's not, because more and more people are coming along saying, I got to get in on this, right? Even though now you're buying GameSpot stock at like $300. I don't know what the current price is, but
$325.
So
yeah,
that's crazy.
Look, Leo,
if this
you
is
and I
the
both
this
know
is the year to date is- graph. It was January 5th. It was $17. It is now $325. And there was a sell-off on Thursday. I'm sure there's some off-market trading going on right now. It's insane. It's insane.
So
are people going to – but don't you think people are going to get hurt by this, Alex, or no?
They are going to get hurt by it.
I mean, we know the hedge funds got hurt. Melvin Capital had to go borrow money from Stephen Cohen.
Yep. To the tune of several $1 billion.
Yeah. So the billionaires bailed out the billionaires.
We didn't do it, which is super important to note. No one knows how long this can stay up because no one thought this was going to happen. And when you discuss people posting their trades on Wall Street Bets and other forums, what they're doing is sharing with a large crowd. And it's not like the old days where you had to go on CNBC to talk about your positions to get people to pay attention. Now you can kind of rally an army of individual traders who have access to things like options and more exotic investments than they didn't used to have. And so now you can really marshal a lot of buying power behind you. People are buying billboards and ads to encourage more people to buy and hold GameStop.
Look at this
stock, which is a tongue twister.
That, you know, Deep Effing Value posted, hold. Of course he wants you to hold. In fact, he wants you to buy more because his value is going to go up. At some point, you have to start wondering about these people's motivations and maybe not buy into this. It's crazy. And I don't think we fully know what's going on. There's a larger thing at play here that actually ties into the events of the last few years. This is essentially mob action, right? I was in a mob when I was a kid. I was protesting against the Vietnam War with a big group of people. We did things that I would never have done by myself. You know, we blocked the freeway. We rocked police cars, stupid things that I would never have done. But when you get in a mob, you lose your mind and you start acting as a single brain in a mob. And we've seen this before. We saw it January 6th. In a way, to me, what's happening in the stock market with GameStop is similar to what happened in the insurrection in the Capitol, is similar to what happened, I guess you could say, in the Arab Spring. And again, what I think we're seeing is how social media, these messaging platforms like Telegram and Discord, WhatsApp, empower the formation of mobs. When I was a kid, you only became a mob because everybody said, let's go down and protest the war in Vietnam on, you know, a certain day. And we all went. And that mob never got much bigger because there wasn't this mass medium. But social media has, in my mind, weaponized the mob. And while this seems benign to me, this is great. I'm glad some hedge funds suffered. They should. But that's today. Tomorrow, it could be less benign.
I think the comparison to the January 6th is a little bit tenuous because that was a rally that the leader of America had called people to show up to. So it was much more centralized than this sort of Reddit Discord type thing.
I'm not making deep effing value equivalent to President Trump. But
that's the point.
But I'm saying that had President Trump not had Twitter and Facebook, had the organizers not had these social media platforms, to me it looks like these social media platforms are ripe for this kind of thing. And this is what we're going to see. And I think we're going to see it a lot more often.
Just to add to that point, there's currently a new meme amongst the same trading groups to squeeze the price of silver. And I have not looked into this because all my money is in boring index funds because of journalism rules. But this is not going to stop. People have now found a lever and they're going to keep trying to move the world as long as they can. And, you know, we saw a lot of issues with Robinhood's ability to stay up and so forth, but they'll figure that out. They'll get that sorted out. And then once those pathways are open, there's not going to be the same kind of like slows to the system. And so I don't know where this goes, but as a person who cares about the financial markets in general, I'm going to be fascinated to see what the next couple of years look like. If we do actually see the revenge of retail traders against the professional money, it will be an inversion of trends that have been going on for decades, you know, and people are going to get hurt, Leo, but it's going to be really fun to watch the financial carnage either way.
I'm Diamond Hands, still holding on to that GameSpot stock. Going to be rich someday. I know I am. Coming up, the other big fad of 2021, NFTs. But first, I would like to talk a little bit about something that's not a fad, Podium. Oh, man, Podium is actually the future for small businesses. And I know it because every time now I leave my dentist's office, my hair cutters, the ice cream parlor down the street, I hear from them. I get a text message. Sometimes it says your next appointment. Sometimes it says, would you like a coupon for your next visit? Sometimes it says, would you like to leave us a review on Yelp or Google? And in every case, that's Podium. Podium is the way to do business in this kind of modern era. Friction-free. It's what your customers want. They like getting that instantaneous feedback from a business they've just used or a business they've visited. And Podium, if you own a business, you know there's already too much to do, can save you a lot of time. Local businesses are turning to Podium to do everything they might do over the phone or through mail, but now can do instantly in a way customers really prefer. Podium makes every interaction as easy as sending a text. You know who else loves it? You will. Your employees will. Because with one inbox, Podium makes it very easy to get things done. Answer requests, offer coupons. By the way, I have to tell you, I used Podium the other day. I was looking for somebody to fix a window in our house, and I sent text messages to the various glaziers listed, I think it was on Yelp. What's interesting is the first one to get back to me was using Podium, and because he got back so fast, he got the gig. Another score, another win for Podium. It's not just a better way to communicate. It's a better way to do everything. Gathering reviews, collecting payments, marketing to your customers. Podium makes it easy as pressing a send button. You'll not only free up more time, you'll grow your business, you'll get more done with Podium, you'll close deals with customers before the competition even has a chance to call them back. You know, I mean, times have changed. It used to be having an answering machine was the thing. Then it was email. Then it was a website. Well, now it's Podium. Communicate with your customers easily, efficiently, the way they want to be communicated with Podium. Join the more than 100,000 businesses that already use Podium to streamline their customer interactions. You can get started for free at Podium, podium.com/twit. If you sign up for a paid Podium account, you can get a free credit card reader. Restrictions apply. That's podium.com/twit. We thank them so much for supporting our year-end best of episode. There was a lot to talk about when it came to NFTs and blockchain. And early in the year, we had the expert, Kevin Rose, to join us and explain what all this madness is all about. Watch.
Good to see you, Leo. Thanks for having me.
Venture capitalist with True Ventures. He's got a brand new podcast. I want to give you a plug right up front. MoFi, the Modern Finance Podcast. You're only in your, you've only done three episodes, only two published so far. But the first one is a must listen. I listened to it immediately because I am completely baffled by this whole crazy NFT thing. We've spent a lot of time talking about the Beeple's $69 million art JPEG sold at Christie's. But you explain it all very well with IMDC investor Aftab Hossein, who is, you know, and you, I guess you're also an investor. You've bought some NFTs.
Yeah, I mean, I was definitely dabbling way back when CryptoPunks first came out, which was probably, well, that was before the standard was actually defined. So two and a half, 3 years ago.
They weren't actually NFTs at first, were they?
That's right. Yeah, the standard was based on the work done with the CryptoPunks project.
Oh, interesting. So they were. So you're smart. I heard you say that you sold. These are the CryptoPunks.
Yeah, they are 25 by 25 pixels.
Yeah, they're icons of zombies, right?
Zombie is one attribute type. Yes.
And
aliens, zombies, and yeah, they all have different mohawks and glasses and beard types. And I mean,
but you buy these, which I don't understand because I see them all right here. I have them all. You buy them so that if I click on the smiling zombie, which apparently you own, I can look at it. I could print it. I could do anything sure. I want with it, but you own it.
That's right. Yeah, you could do the same thing with get a high res copy of the Mona Lisa and print it out. And
that's
hang it
true.
Up in your house, but you don't have it.
That's true. So it's like got the Mona Lisa of smiling zombies. Is that it?
Yeah, I mean it's basically just a way to use the blockchain to prove that someone actually has ownership over something.
So that makes a lot of sense.
And ownership.
That
by
makes a lot.
Cementing
of sense.
It in the blockchain.
That's a real problem with artworks, with baseball cards, with any collectible is attribution and who owns it, but also is it real? Is it and so blockchain solves that.
And the third piece that's really important is how many were made. I mean,
right.
One of the things that happened in the 90s around baseball cards and collectibles and comic books is, you know, there's a great story. We all, of course, know the very famous franchise of the Wolverine. And the very first Wolverine comic is still $150. And I dug into this. I'm like, how this was made in the 80s. How can this possibly be? And it turns out they printed like something like 300,000 of them. And didn't tell anyone. They sold as many as they could, and which makes sense as a business. But as collectors, you didn't know that, you know. And so the blockchain gives you a way to say proven scarcity, proven
right.
ownership. So that's nice.
So there is another way, a biological way to barcode and to track authenticity, and that's DNA. So you can spray custom DNA on just about anything. It's odorless, it's colorless, it leaves no residue, it leaves no mark. And then you have physical, so blockchain is great, but you know,
it's not physical.
Physical way.
In fact,
yeah, I mean, the
CryptoPunk is not in the blockchain, right? The image itself is not in the blockchain, Kevin, just the URL.
Well, right. That's not true because with CryptoPunks, it was only a 25 by 25.
Oh, they're so small. You could
embedded a hash of the. Okay. Yeah, exactly.
You're
right. In any modern, like the Beeples, all that stuff, it is just a pointer to like an IPFS type, asset.
Right. Well, at least it's IPFS.
And there are problems.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I think all of that works well as long as you have a ton of redundancy built in. But
yeah, because if it's just
one of the cool
if
things,
it were a web URL, it could, you know, the server could go down. At least with IPFS, it's a distributed file system. And yeah. So in theory, not going to go away.
You could spray DNA fragments.
So I'm not going to ask you. It's probably it's not the traditional method of spraying DNA, I'm assuming. It's some other high-tech
method.
No, Leo,
that's not what I was talking about.
Okay. That's where my mind went. It's a sneeze, right? You sneeze on it.
Sure.
I'm sure, if you think about it, that probably a few Van Goghs have his DNA on them. But you're not talking about that.
No, I'm not talking about that. You know, one of the really cool things that's happened, one of the positive after effects of the virus is that messenger RNA, which has been around forever, it finally found a use case, a business case.
To make the vaccines in this case.
That's right. And mRNA is a pretty cool technology that has some knock-on effects, and one of which is looking at RNA and DNA in sort of a new light. So you can, DNA is like nature's hard drive. You can store a ton of stuff in it, and it doesn't go anywhere. And likewise, you can use DNA as a tracking system. So if you've got a really valuable collection of comic books, not Wolverine, but something else more valuable, you know, one way to physically mark products like that, artifacts that you can authenticate in the future is using DNA fragments.
One of the advantages of blockchain in this regard is it's distributed and everybody has a copy. There's no, with DNA, you'd still have to have some registry somewhere of what the what's in that RNA. If, I mean, it doesn't have to be RNA. It could be any encoding method for encoding a long digit.
Right. I mean, it's like a, you can encode spores too. It's just, it's like a barcode. But yes, you would still need, a registry that should be distributed.
That works great for like individual objects. But if you're going to do something like say fractional ownership of a digital object,
that wouldn't be possible.
You know, smart contracts enable things like artworks to change over time based on rule sets, like really kind of fun things like that as well are pretty cool with some of the NFT stuff.
I think people, and I include myself in this, get distracted by trying to wrap their mind around, well, Beeple made a JPEG, which is infinitely reproducible, and then was able to sell it for $69.3 million to somebody who now can claim ownership in some abstract way. And we get wrapped around this notion of collectibles, physical versus virtual objects and all of that. And you know, you can go either way on that. I mean, I'm kind of the opinion it's pretty speculative, but so are collectibles. I mean, you don't buy a Hannes Wagner baseball card because it has any intrinsic value. You buy it because you think either you're really a big fan of the Pittsburgh Pirates or you think it's going to have more value in down the road and you can sell it. It's a way of storing value, just like, unfortunately, a lot of artworks now are ways of storing value. They're not hung on any wall. They're stored in a locker at some airport to avoid customs and taxes. But they're a store of value, and you know you'll be able to sell them at some point, probably for more than you paid for it.
Right.
So I acknowledge that blockchain is a better way to store value. But I think people like me get all tied in a knot over this. Well, what are you kids doing? This is silly. There's also, and let me ask you about this, Kevin, because you didn't address this in Modern Finance. There's also an environmental concern, isn't there? I mean, there's a lot of energy being used to create these things, and every transaction uses a lot of energy.
I think the energy consumption of proof of work blockchain has been known for quite some time. I mean, there's it's horrible. And so, I mean, that's why there's a lot of work and effort going into making these chains just eco-friendly. I mean, if you take a look at all the layer two scaling solutions for Ethereum, everything is they're doing with optimistic rollups, these are like very lightweight ways to do cryptographically proven transfers without having to write it back to the main chain. So without spending a lot of resource power until we get to something that is proof of stake, which is not proof of work, which is not using very intensive CPU or GPUs to do all these transaction processing, which is on the Ethereum roadmap. I mean, this stuff is coming.
It's been on the roadmap for a long time though,
Kevin. Yeah, I know, but you're also talking about, you know, how many billions of dollars of, you gotta be very careful when you're changing directions of a plane of that size, right? Like if you're setting a new destination, like you want to really battle and harden the code. And so, you know, there's been some ETH2 is like they've crossed a couple of major milestones and staking is the next big one.
And that will eliminate the grotesque energy expenditure.
Yes. And there's already other chains out there that like are getting a lot of traction that are already green from the get-go. Chia, Bram Cohen, the creator of BitTorrent, just launched his coin here just 4 or 5 days ago.
You actually interview him for the
very efficient green
for the podcast. What's that? You just interviewed him for the podcast.
Yeah. It's a very efficient, super green cryptocurrency. It's going to have support for smart contracts and other things on top of it. Solana, super, like talk about high bandwidth, high throughput. They can do 50,000 transactions a second, and it is super efficient and green. So, you know, these are all problems that are being worked out. But I certainly acknowledge that today it sucks. And of course, like, dependent upon where you're getting your energy from. Like, there are a lot of miners that will go next to very cheap sources, which can be hydroelectric. They can be, you know, solar.
Can be renewables.
They're mining in those environments.
Sure. In fact, it only makes sense to mine where electricity is cheap, because otherwise you're probably not making a profit.
Right.
It kind of brings up the issue of, I saw some wag tweet, Elon Musk said Tesla now will accept Bitcoin to purchase a Tesla automobile. And, of course, some wag pointed out that you might as well just put gas engines in them, Elon, because all the benefit, the environmental benefit of an electric vehicle is kind of abrogated by using Bitcoin to pay for them.
I mean, yes and no. I think that there's a couple things here. Like, what are the payment rails behind the scenes? If you're going, let's say, I don't know what they're using for on the merchant side to accept Bitcoin, but let's just say it's Coinbase, right?
Yeah.
If you're going Coinbase to Coinbase, you're not doing anything.
There's no
you're
conversion.
Not actually writing to the chain. Right. Yeah. Exactly.
I'm still wondering what, I'm like so curious now what Nicholas got from the NBA on his NFT.
Open it.
Maybe in the background I could open it.
Let's do an unboxing.
Yeah.
Did you get a box?
I guess a digital box. Let me.
How can you do an unboxing of a digital box?
I don't know if I could show it on my screen. I can't share my screen. I probably could.
Yeah, you're on Zoom. You can share your screen with us. You got to make presenter on the Zoom thing, I think, John.
I'm waiting for the day now when like somebody does like a crazy dunk and like the kids are asking each other, is that dunk on the blockchain yet?
They've sold, like I said, $200 million of highlights. NBATopShot.com. You just did it for research, I'm sure, Nicholas, right?
I have a friend who you know, is mega into it. He's spending like hundreds of dollars. He's one of those speculators. And I was like, oh, that's, you know, I had been reading about it.
So this is what you bought. You bought a pack. It is.
Yes.
It's just like a baseball cards. Yeah. It's, yep. And so which one did you get?
I pre-ordered the base pack. That's the other thing is that, you know, they release these things in tranches. It's like, if you want like the fancy smancy pack, well, you have to, you know, you have to wait in line.
They're all
like
sold out now.
Yeah.
Look at
it's
that.
Very interesting how they kind of like.
They're forever sold out, I presume.
They're so smart. Yeah, they're sold out forever. They're so smart because.
They did say this shocked them. They sold way more than what they expected.
Whoa. Yeah.
They were super surprised.
Okay, just a little tip. They look a little bit like condom wrappers. You might want to change the size of that, make it look more like baseball cards. But other than that, I see. I would go for this one. Deck the Hoops, $230, sold out. So you just bought a base set. Did you get?
You don't actually get anything physical in the mail, do you? It's all
no. You don't get this package or anything. That's what's hysterical about this. They make it look like you're going to get something. Well, you get a link, you get an email. What'd you get?
And it's funny too, because they make you wait in a queue. Like a couple of weeks ago, I was in line with 150,000 other people trying to buy, you know, one of these packs.
That's smart. You want to create this false sense of urgency and this scarcity. Yeah.
And the folks in the Discord are like freaking out. They're like, oh my God, there's 100,000 people ahead of me. There's no way I'm getting. And you're waiting in this queue for hours and you're just kind of like,
that's hysterical.
Am I getting it?
And with the post office being congested because of DeJoy, it took even longer for it to get to you, right?
Oh yeah, you didn't have to mail it. They don't mail it.
Yeah,
don't mail it.
I don't know. I have it. I don't know if I could open it live. I don't know.
Yeah, you don't have to. That's all right.
All right.
I just thought it'd be good for our YouTube numbers if you did an unboxing.
Well, that's actually funny you bring that up, because that is like a burgeoning piece of content, like people opening packs live and they have like hype videos, and it's actually quite clever, I guess.
If I were smart, I would have promoted this. I would have said, next week, Nicholas De Leon is coming on. He's going to open his pack. This is huge. I would have done 4 or 5 videos all week long building this up. See, I'm not good at this stuff.
He could have been the Geraldo of Rivera.
Are you talking about Al Capone's safe?
Exactly.
Yeah, that's,
which ended up having, what, nothing in it? It was like dust?
Nothing in it.
Nothing. Man, wow. There's always
I can save it for next time. I won't open it. Maybe we'll coordinate and I can open it live.
I would understand. I don't know. Maybe there'll be something in there that I don't think there would be that would give away like your credit card number or something.
I don't. But, no, I don't think so.
I don't think so.
It's just what, GIFs. Yeah.
But what happens if somebody offers you $10,000 for it between now and the next show?
It's okay.
I find that unlikely because it's a standard pack or it's a base pack, whatever they call
but
it.
But only 5,000 other people have it.
Yeah. It's, probably not the best GIFs in this one, if I had to guess.
Yeah.
But we'll see.
Just so that we can prepare for this next time, give me the shock look that you do on YouTube, Nicholas. So like, oh my God, I just opened it. It's amazing. Give me that look. Come on. You can do it.
Oh my.
No,
oh.
No, come on. But yeah, there you go. There you go. Stick out your tongue. Ah! Yeah, that's it.
And then I get up that. And I run around. And green screen rolls over.
Yeah, we got it.
There's your. That's your.
That's the thumbnail.
That's your thumbnail right now. You know, Leo, you should make an NFT out of the first episode of Twit.
I have them.
Right.
So I have.
Guarantee you,
I would buy that.
Somebody
would
buy it.
Who would buy that? I would buy that.
Would you buy it?
I might actually buy that. I remember where I was sitting where you guys recorded the first Twit, actually. So,
but what would that mean in terms of copyright? Would that mean that the person who bought it would own the copyright or just...
Well, we don't copyright them. They're Creative Commons. We don't do anything. I would just... It would basically be me signing it digitally, authenticating that this is the first episode of Twit.
We're letting somebody... I'll give it to you. Own the first edition. So they own the one of a kind digital copy or the digital original essentially of it, and then all other versions are copies of it, right?
Except I don't know if I could do that because I don't really know if I have the original.
Well, it doesn't. So that's the thing. Right?
It becomes
Dorothy
the original.
Have the original tweet.
You designate
where's
one.
No,
of the
there is. Where is it? So John has gone through our old hard drives, and he is actually. He has this concept. John, I think, wants us to make money. Big mistake there, John. So he's given me a list. These are pre-show clips from 2008. Me and Paul Thurrott, pre-show Windows Weekly. Me and Megan Maroney, pre-show Jumping Monkeys. A live stream we did on building the ultimate game machine with Colleen Henry and Ryan Shrout. Security Now pre-show. These are all from 2008, from August 2008. And the Daily Giz Fizz from 2008. It's on here. So these are now, I those are the originals. I just blessed them. So then what do I do? I don't know. I need Medicovan.
You have to tokenize them. Yeah.
To tokenize them.
Leo, I bet if you sold the first episode of Twit as an NFT and took the proceeds... And put it in Bitcoin and held it for $10.
Yeah.
I bet you that would be worth $1 million.
I would lose my password. And you know, I have 8 Bitcoin in a wallet. I have 8 Bitcoin right now in a wallet that I can't get into because I don't remember the password.
What's that worth?
That you got from like Mt. Gox back when it was.
No. When Bitcoin first started, I downloaded Bitcoin Core, like the software that the Bitcoin Foundation had, and that created a wallet. Yep. And at some point, I was smart enough and dumb enough to password protect it, but not record the password.
Oh, so you've got it in cold storage. And
I have the wallet.dat file. And then we put up a QR code with the account on the website as part of our tip jar, because for a while I think we still have a tip jar. I just, no one knows where it is. And people gave me a tenth of a Bitcoin or whatever. And it ended up being 7.85 Bitcoin. I know, because I can see the wallet and I know how much is in it. I know all the transactions, but I just can't unlock it. So what is that worth? That's $480,000 right now.
Wow.
That's right.
It's amazing.
I'm an idiot.
Will you ever be able to recover that value?
Yeah. My feeling is, if I had been able to unlock it at any time in the last 5 years, I would have sold it.
Right.
When Bitcoin was $100, I would have sold it. Yeah. So all I've done is gain value. I figure not being able to sell it is the best thing that ever happened to me. And
if you were applying for a loan, could you use that on your financial statement as part of your net worth?
If you can't access it. So I'm figuring here's my plan. This is my long range plan. Someday quantum computers are going to happen. And there'll be a computer fast enough to crack this wallet.
To crack that password. You're probably right.
Yeah, by then it'll be worth millions.
You're right.
Maybe worth 100 million. We'll have more in just a little bit. In fact, we're going to talk about, because one of the big stories of the week was, of the year, I should say, was about Congress investigating Facebook. some of Facebook's plans for Instagram coming up in just a little bit. Our show today brought to you by Nareva. Complicated and costly. That's been the state of audio conferencing for big spaces for a long time. Choosing a traditional system could entail difficult software design issues, selecting from a kind of dizzying array of separate mics, speakers, DSPs, and more. You got to get a company to come in, map the space, then you bring in technicians to install, often very invasive and certainly very expensive. And that can take your meeting room, your huddle room offline for days. Really, I think this is a good example of an industry that was just primed for a leap in technology. It's the same kind of one that's changed so many other sectors, especially during COVID. That's why Nareva has really come at a time that we need it. Nareva created the revolutionary microphone mist technology. It's a patented technology that make one or two integrated microphones and speaker bars work for a giant room, fill the room with thousands of virtual microphones. It is a perfect, affordable solution for today's bigger meeting rooms. No dead zones. Everybody can be heard anywhere in the room, no matter where they're facing, no matter how they're socially distancing. Frankly, I think this is going to be the future of conference rooms, where it's a comfortable, engaging space, and you don't have to pay attention to the microphone. That's the best way. Meeting participants, classes, it's great for schools, can simply talk and move naturally in the space, and they'll be heard clearly by remote participants. It's just a more natural way to run conference audio. And thanks to continuous calibration, your rooms are instantly and always ready with optimized audio. No outside technician required, no matter how the configuration changes, no matter how many people or how few people in the room, Nareva works first time every time. And man, has it simplified installation. No installers coming in, running wires everywhere, drilling holes in the wall. It's a 30-minute job you can do yourself. I've done it. It's simple. It's just like installing a sound bar. It means big savings on time and cost compared to traditional systems. So it works better and it costs less. Seems like a no-brainer to me. Simplified management, too. You get the Nareva console, which gives IT the power to monitor, manage, and adjust the systems from everywhere. No need for IT to move from room to room. So it means you can have many Nareva connected rooms and manage them all from a central console. It's just great. So I guess it's time to ask yourself, do you want to go with a costly, complicated, traditional system or make the leap to simple and economical Nareva? Nureva.com. Nareva. Nureva.com. It's simple. It's just the right way to do it. Nareva, we thank you so much for supporting our special best of episode. We really appreciate that. Boy, it was a lot to talk about with Facebook and Instagram this year. Here's a plan at the time that seemed like a bad idea. They've backed down since. Instagram for kids. What could possibly go wrong? Internal Instagram post obtained by BuzzFeed News says, quote, "We have identified youth work as a priority for Instagram and have added it to our H1 priority list." Youth work.
You know, youths. Like, you know, when they were like minors and stuff back in the day. Now instead of exploiting children by sending them on the ground, we exploit them with ads.
Yeah. This is Vishal Shah, who's Instagram's vice president of product, writing on an employee message board. But of course, nothing is private these days. "We will be building a new youth pillar within the community product group to focus on two things." This is, I think, informative about how they think about these things. "Accelerating our integrity and privacy work to ensure the safest possible experience for teens, and building a version of Instagram that lets people under the age of 13 safely use Instagram for the first time." For the first time. Actually, Instagram, like almost everything else, because of COPPA, the Child Online Protection and Privacy Act, will not allow you to join if you're under 13. But, of course, I don't think that stops anybody. They don't make any real effort to verify that. But
this makes me think about cigarettes when they used to advertise to kids to understand that if you don't start at a certain age, then you're not going to continue on.
So get them young.
Yeah. Get them young, indoctrinate quickly. And people will, once you're used to an ecosystem, you're comfortable. You're going to stay and keep on using it. That's their thought. That's their hope for it. Even though, this is not good. Social media is not great for kids because most kids don't understand what they're doing, what they're posting. Not everyone has Owen as a dad. Let's just say it. Owen, you have to be all of our dads.
He's a good dad. Yeah, be all our dad. Yeah.
And you should start. This has nothing to do with indoctrinating them. This has to do with TikTok and Snapchat. They are losing the youth at an alarming rate. They need to do something to bring the youth back because, sending a kid to Instagram is like sending them Facebook or a letter by pigeon. They don't want to go there. You know what I mean? Like, if it's not on TikTok, it's not real.
Now, maybe this is not the audience, but when I watch TikTok, a lot of TikTokers say, check out my Instagram account. Like they do both. But that's like people trying to be influencers, you're saying.
It's also the fact of check out my YouTube channel.
Right.
Check out my Twitter. Check out my whatever. If you're already here and you love me, I need you to love me on other platforms to build up my maybe I can get you here and get you there. So that's why I do it. But 90% of what you watch on Instagram anymore that's interesting has a TikTok name floating around it. They've already posted it on TikTok, and then they put it on Instagram. By the time I look at something on Instagram, my daughter's looking at me like I'm a 92-year-old man. She's like, I was laughing at that 2 weeks ago, bro.
Right.
Like, come on. Like, you know what I mean? Because I don't have the same algorithm she has on TikTok. So she's in the cool hip from the future TikTok. I'm in the, hey, let me sell you some socks and a good dad joke TikTok. Okay?
Now this I would buy.
Has all the cool fun stuff.
This I would buy. If I could say to a TikTok, I would like that cool hip younger algorithm. Can I trade my silver haired algorithm in? I would buy that. Wouldn't you
all you have to do is give a 17-year-old, give your son the TikTok for like a week and you'll be cool.
He'll fix it.
It'll change everything.
Oh, yeah. He'll fix the algorithm because it learns really quick what you're into, bro. Like, real quick.
Oh, that's disappointing. When I think about what I see on TikTok now, maybe
it's all your fault.
It's all my fault.
It's the way the internet works, right? So the internet, if you look at my Twitter or my Facebook, they think that I'm a 71-year-old white man that lives in Los Angeles or New York City. I get ads for old dating sites. I get dads for...
Is that because you do that on purpose or is that just who you are?
Oh, I did that because I don't want them selling things to me. I like to know what they're selling me. So when they're selling me old stuff, I know that they're going by my age and my location. Yeah. You know what I mean? They think that I'm Owen from
LA. I have to say it works because I really enjoy TikTok. So they're obviously picking the right videos for me. I might not enjoy Henry's TikTok because it would be for a young guy.
Yeah, their algorithm is impressive. It is impressive technology.
Yeah. Is it the best?
Scary.
What? And how is Snapchat still in the game? Didn't Instagram kick Snapchat's butt with their stories and all that? For the olds.
Did you see this on my phone?
What?
Didn't see it, right? That's the point, because that's why Snapchat is still cool. The kids are on there because they're putting up stuff that they don't want people to see, and it goes away.
Okay. And TikTok's exact opposite. It's stuff you want everybody to see.
Yep.
So I should never go to a second location. Is that the rule?
That's the rule. Never go to a second location.
Okay, I'm learning. I'm just learning.
Rule. That's the rule.
Jeff Bezos retiring, stepping down as CEO. He's going to be the chairman of the board, but less focused on day-to-day operations. He's handing over the reins to Andy Jassy. He's kind of, maybe this is another one of the, it seems like the whole show's been about corporate spin and PR. And maybe this is more of the same. In the letter, he says, if you've read some of the news reports, you might think we don't care about our employees. Well, we do, but maybe we ought to do better. He's coming off a victory. Of course, the Alabama warehouses voted against the union, fairly substantially voted against the union. He says, while voting results were lopsided and our direct relationship with employees is strong, it's clear to me we need a better vision for how we create value from employees, a vision for their success. I'm sure Amazon will continue to fight unions. On the other hand, you know, there are things they can do to make it better to work at Amazon. He said, our employees are sometimes accused of being desperate souls and treated as robots. That's not accurate. Remember the, was it a book that said that if you didn't cry at your desk once a day at Amazon, you really weren't working hard enough? if any shareholders are concerned that Earth's best employer and Earth's safest place to work, that's his goal, might dilute our focus on Earth's most customer-centric company, let me set your mind at ease. Think of it this way. If we can operate two businesses as different as consumer e-commerce and Amazon Web Services and do both at the highest level, we can certainly do the same with these two vision statements. I'm confident they will reinforce each other. Spin, or do you think he genuinely is being, you know, a little affected by all of the blowback and wants to do something to make it a better company?
Well, this is Jeff Bezos's last letter to shareholders as CEO. So what he's thinking when he's writing this is legacy, legacy, legacy. And for him, he's reading the news and he's seeing, you know, what happened with the high profile Twitter battle that led employees to end up like sharing photos of them, the bottles that they've peed in and letters telling them to stop pooping in bags with the press, which basically like, you know, Amazon is under fire. And for the way that it treats employees, and it's on its way to becoming the biggest employer in the U.S. It's added a million employees in wow. under a decade.
Wow.
And it just keeps adding 100,000, 200,000 a year. And so this is going to be Jeff Bezos' legacy, because at the end of the day, you know, he's going to be the person who's going to be responsible for the state of the American worker, because the American worker is largely moving from places like the factory, which produce things, to places like the fulfillment center, which distributes things. And so Bezos is going to, you know, this stuff is going to continue to grow. Amazon added 50 million Prime members in the last year, up from 150 million.
That's stunning.
33% growth.
First time we've ever heard that number, by the way, 200 yeah, million exactly. Amazon Prime subscribers. Yeah.
So I think Bezos is thinking, you know, when people look back at him, they're going to look back at the e-commerce company he built, but they'll also look at the broader transformation that he led in terms of the economy and the way that work is structured. And of course, there were other factors that were involved there. And so that's why I think we heard so much about the worker there. And now, does Amazon care? Yeah, actually, I think Amazon cares a lot more than we end up hearing in the press reports. I don't think it's a miserable place for so many people to work. It can be really tough. But I do think that the reality there is somewhere in between what we hear in some of like the worst. It's not like everybody goes in and brings their bottle to work, you know, and pees in it twice a day. You know, there are good jobs at Amazon, but they definitely have room to improve. And I kind of, you know, the Amazon was freaking out when people were talking about the way that their employees are treated. And you know, there is some righteous indignation that they can have. The United States politicians are the ones that signed trade deals like NAFTA and encouraged China to join the WTO, which ended up having us trade those production jobs for fulfillment jobs. And Amazon, you know, pays $15 minimum wage, where the federal government has a $7.25 minimum wage. And so, you know, I kind of see Amazon's side a little bit when, you know, they're looking at these, you know, politicians from the U.S. government saying, you got to treat workers better. And Amazon's like, you're supposed to be looking after the workers in America. I mean, of course, Amazon, we talked about, has lobbyists, but, you know, there have been decades where our politicians have had a chance to make the situation better, and they've failed.
You can also make the case that voting down the union in Alabama was a vote of confidence from the workers, saying we prefer Amazon management. We don't need a union.
I'd buy that more if Amazon didn't go through the painstaking union busting process that it did. If Amazon had that vote be, you know, let that vote be fair and didn't like compel people to go into education systems and, you know, start like getting the post office to like have this mailbox in that, you know, might have made some people think that they were going to read their ballots.
Right.
That might be one thing. I mean, why do you, if you really think that you can stand up based off of the merits, you don't need to bring the union busting firm in. You obviously have a right to defend yourself against unionization if you don't want it. But to just go through such effort and to be so against it, like, I don't think this was you know, entirely the workers standing up and saying, we don't want a union. Obviously, Amazon had a role in it. And Amazon's like, this wasn't a victory for us. It's what the workers wanted. But Amazon corporate, it was definitely a victory for them. They had a side. They picked a side. They pushed it real hard. And then we saw the impact of it.
It's an interesting goal to become Earth's best employer and Earth's safest place to work. A lot of this letter was talking about how we already are great. So I'm not sure exactly what he plans to do to make it the best employer and the safest place to work.
Well, there's a couple things here. Number one, Bezos is doing what Bill Gates did 15 years ago.
And Andrew Carnegie did before him, right?
And Andrew Carnegie did back in the, you know, several generations ago. And people were skeptical about Bill Gates walking away from a day-to-day role with Microsoft, and yet that's exactly what he did.
And became a philanthropist.
His primary focus there.
I guess like Andrew Carnegie, some of that was to renovate his reputation.
I think to a large extent, but there was also, I think people who know Bill will say that there was some genuine personal transformation.
Interesting.
That happened along the way. But I think the other thing about the whole union vote, there's two factors there that we really need to keep in mind. One is that this vote took place in probably, you know, perhaps the worst possible place to have a union vote.
This is one of the reddest states in the country.
States with one of the most powerful so-called right to work traditions. Right. I just get angry when I have to use the phrase right to work, because it's the exact opposite of what it should be, you know. But right now, the United States is one of the most anti-union countries in the world. And so basically, Bezos is operating as the kinder, gentler face of what every corporation is doing. They don't have to bust unions anymore. The unions are in shambles. They're in shards on the ground. And so, you know, and with an NLRB that isn't able to really influence the course of the election very much, this one seemed kind of preordained. It's a country that's anti-union. It's a state that's aggressively red and anti-union. So I guess this didn't surprise me at all. And for Bezos to come back and say, well, thank goodness that our employees love us so much. Nah, I don't think that's what it means.
He quoted 94% of our employees say they would recommend Amazon to a friend as a place to work. He says, we want to make that 100%, but 94 is not bad.
It's better than Wendy's.
Well, and it pays better than Wendy's, I might add, and pays better than Walmart, I might add. There are plenty of...
Yeah, and at the end of the day, like, the workers did vote. You know, they did get to vote.
They got to vote.
I can't discount their choices,
This is Jeff Bezos's... it's his farewell. Do you think this is his attempt to kind of leave on a high note and then just kind of walk away, wash his hands of the whole thing? How well will Amazon do without Jeff Bezos at the helm? I think for whatever you don't like about him, you have to say strategically, he's amazing, right? I mean, he's brilliant. Or no?
Go ahead.
Alex, you first.
I would just say that the culture that he's built, when you start to look at it up front, and, you know, of course, there's an element of how workers are treated. I think it could be better.
I think there's a big difference between the experience in the warehouse and the experience in the executive suite, right? I mean, they're two different jobs.
No doubt. But there are some constants where, like, both workers in the fulfillment centers and workers in the corporate offices can have their jobs automated away.
Right.
And we'll have to adjust. And in fact, this past week on Big Technology Podcast, I had one of the people who worked in Amazon's corporate office, a woman named Elaine Kwan, who had her her uh, her job automated away. She was on the phone with Gucci and Versace stocking the fulfillment centers. And then all of a sudden that was handed over to machine learning. So it's, you know, everybody inside that company needs to be able to adapt and embrace change. And you look at most big companies and they just kind of make something and they stop. Like this was the case with Microsoft for a long time, where they made Windows. They were the desktop operating system and they stopped. And only after we moved to mobile and the cloud did they actually have to catch up. And they've done a good job, although they were pretty late to the game. But you look at Amazon and they're always one step ahead of what's going on. You know, bookstore, then selling everyone through a first-party marketplace to build a third-party marketplace, logistics and fulfillment, voice computing, hardware manufacturing with something like the Kindle, not to mention the fact that they're a grocer, an Academy Award-winning movie studio, and now they're moving into healthcare. And you don't excel at all that stuff unless your culture, your leadership, and your processes and internal technology are locked in. And I don't think there's anybody on the planet right now that's done a better job at that than Bezos. So I think the company will be able to survive. And the big question is whether they're going to be able to keep that mentality that Bezos has instilled, you know, from his position at the top after he leaves. Jesse, of course, has shadowed him as his technical advisor back in the day before he built AWS. He's done a good job with AWS, built it into a massive business. But you never quite know until the person at the top leaves. And we know with Microsoft, Bill Gates left and they put Steve Ballmer in. Who was just there to, you know, ended up making money and they needed to make another leadership change to get back, you know, to their more inventive ways. So that'll be a question with Amazon. But I think Bezos's legacy as somebody who is who's been able to build a powerhouse company, I don't think that's ever going to, you know, go into question in the long term.
I'm now sleeping on an 8 sleep bed.
Nice. Yep. Kevin is a wealth of information on stuff like that.
They just pushed a new update to their app, which is terrible. So if anybody at 8 Sleep is listening, please, please, please fix the jankiness. It was good before and now it is challenging. Yeah.
This is the problem with IoT mattresses.
Yeah.
The mattress succeeds, lives on, but the software
fails. Yeah, yeah. I will tell you though, I sleep great. I sleep great with a thermal regulation.
That's cooling is very important, isn't it?
And heating. I cook myself awake.
Oh, that's interesting. So you chill yourself to sleep and you cook yourself to wake.
I do. And I haven't woken up to an actual alarm in months. So I'm up at 5:40 every morning.
So the software, so the whole idea of these mattresses, 8sleep.com spelled out, is it lets you control the temperature in the mattress. And with it has heating and cooling coils. So the software, you're saying the software, Amy, says, okay, it when you want to go to sleep and it cools the mattress and then when you want to wake up and it heats it up.
But it gives you a bunch of other metrics like what your REM cycles were, what your respiration is, what your heartbeat is, makes suggestions for how to get more restful sleep. It's actually up until this, I'm sure they're going to fix whatever the problem was. And actually, they would be a good advertiser for this show because I'm sure everybody listening is, this is their kind of
thing. And you don't have to buy the mattress. You can just get a pod.
No. We love our, we have a really nice mattress.
Oh, so you didn't get the mattress. You got the cover.
No, I didn't. No, we just have a cover.
That's a lot more affordable, I'm sure.
It is. Yeah. And if you've got a mattress that you really love, you don't need the whole thing.
Holy cow. I love my Casper. I'm not sure I'm going to spend $1,895 for a mattress pad. But I guess you need it because it's got a big heating unit and all that stuff.
My husband and I both, and he has a weighted thermal blanket, and I sleep under a 20-pound blanket.
Yeah.
I'm sleeping better than I've ever slept. And I had chronic insomnia. Wow.
You know, what is it worth to sleep well? I mean, absolutely.
Yeah, definitely.
Up any price.
Sleep Tech is under, like, if you're like in the know, then you become a super geek overnight. But
how hot do you have to get it to be to wake up?
So I have mine set to +8. I don't know what the actual temperature is, but I think it's around 115.
It's not like
115 degrees.
Okay, so it's 8 above your body temperature. It's not about making you so uncomfortable. Oh, you do get hot.
Yeah, no. I get like so uncomfortable that I don't know the, it might be 120. I don't know. But no, it's like you want to be up because you're.
It's hot. Not,
yeah, but you wake up and you're like, I'm like awake. I'm ready. I'm well rested versus like jolting awake to an alarm clock when your body's not quite, you know, you haven't gradually come out of your sleep.
I hate alarm clocks. Yeah. Yeah. So this was the number one way you got rid of your insomnia, or there were other?
No. Years of cognitive behavioral therapy.
Yeah.
Also,
my son is going through this. He cannot sleep all night. He cannot. He lies awake a long, long time. And I feel like he's suffering because of it. So anything.
Yeah. So Bose makes.
I have those. Those ridiculous earbuds that make sound. Yeah.
I also use those. I work with brown noise during the day and I sleep with pink noise at night.
Sorry. See, I found the trick. The way I hacked my insomnia, because Amy, I'm exactly like you. I just have fought it for years. Is I found out if I get an audiobook that I really, really, really know well, like something I've read so many times, I kind of can guess what the next sentence
like
is going
Expanse,
to be.
The Expanse, yes.
Like The Expanse. This is why I've listened to it so much. What I do is I crack an Audible file. I hope I can say that on here. I own it legally. And then turn it into an MP3 and I put it on an iPod Touch. And then I get earbuds and I listen to this novel again and again all night long. And the reason the hack works is because when you get busy brain at like 3 a.m, it's because you're thinking like, oh, I've got to do this tomorrow. I've got to do this tomorrow. I've got to do this tomorrow. But if it's a story you've listened to a ton, then you can kind of follow it, but you can also drift off and just start thinking about random things. And this has been the magic bullet for my insomnia.
Listening to books,
I think that's like a linguistic.
But I don't want to miss anything. So I love that idea. Listen to something you already heard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's like linguistic counting, right?
Like counting sheep, you mean?
Right. Most people who count already know how to count. You already know sequentially what's coming next.
Right.
Right. So it's reducing the processing power. And when you're focused on a single thing, all of the chatter, gets quiet.
Chatter is the problem, isn't it?
Chatter is the problem.
Yeah. I find as I get older, my mind is just an empty slate now. So I just I go.
Hey, Leo, before we go, can I ask you one last question?
Yes.
So have you NFT'd? Is there an
NFT? I have never NFT'd. I am proud to say.
Are you going to?
Never going to. Well, I'm glad Amy Webb's sleeping well. thank you, Amy. We love Amy. She's going to be back, by the way, in a couple of weeks. We're going to do a very special looking forward version, a future version of Twitch. She wanted to do this. She's a futurist, as you know. And she said, why don't we do an episode where we just talk about kind of thinking about the future of tech? We thought, this is a great idea. We're going to be joined, I'm very happy to say, by my favorite science fiction author, Daniel Suarez, the author of Freedom, TM, and many other great books. It's his job. It's especially to think about the future. So, and we're going to get a scientist. We haven't decided yet who, but we're going to get a scientist to join us. So a futurist, a sci-fi author, and a scientist walk into a room and there will be an amazing twit. Is that next? I think it's next week, isn't it, Jason? That will be, or is it 2 weeks from now? Jason's checking the calendar. Anyway,
it's next week.
Next week, the 9th. Okay. That'll be a very special twit. So this week we're looking back. Next week, a look forward should be really, really fun. But I'm thrilled about this because I've been a customer for a while. We're talking about Blue Land. You know, Lisa and I have been really trying to cut back on our use of plastics. It's estimated 5 billion plastic hand soap and cleaning bottles are thrown away every year. We've turned to water bottles instead of plastic bottles. I've stopped using plastic shave razors. I really want to cut down our plastic use. We don't use plastic bags anymore. All of that just goes in the landfill and it never degrades. It's just there forever, not to mention all the fossil fuels it uses to make it. That's why when we found Blue Land, we were really excited. It's not just, by the way, fossil fuels. These bottles are also made of water. So that's another thing we don't have enough of. People, it's 2022. Stop wasting water. Stop throwing out plastic. What you want is Blue Land, a great revolutionary refill cleaning system instead. Blue Land was founded on the belief that a cleaner planet starts by eliminating plastic waste. You know, we talk a lot about cleaning up the plastic waste in the ocean. But the best way to get rid of plastic waste in the ocean is never to create it in the first place. Blue Land makes a great, powerful, effective cleaners, a range of cleaners for your entire home that eliminate waste. The idea is simple. Buy the bottle once, refill it forever. No more plastic waste. Of course, the only thing you'll need to do is get rid of all that outdated eco-friendly stuff that's more expensive and less effective, because Blue Land works. Just fill Blue Land's beautiful Instagrammable bottles. That's what they call them. They are beautiful. They're blue with warm water. You pop in one of the hand soap or spray cleaner tablets. That's all the factory's doing, by the way. They're shipping all that water with just a little bit of, you know, cleaning product in there. Why do that? Why do that? Within minutes, you just add the important ingredients to the water from your own house. You didn't have to ship it. You've got a powerful cleaning product. And the most incredible, by the way, the smells are amazing. There's agave. There's pearine lemon, lavender, eucalyptus. It's just, they smell great. And most importantly, they work. They work. We all want to make the planet a better place, but we also don't want to sacrifice to do it, right? We don't want to use ineffective, eco-friendly products. Well, this is an effective product that's better, that works, uses less water, doesn't use the plastic, and cleans great. Check out their Clean Essentials Kit, their Hand Soap Duo, the plastic-free laundry and dishwasher tablets. Blue Land has something for every inch of your home. And by the way, back by very popular demand, if you've been a Blue Land customer, you'll be thrilled to hear this. Blue Land's toilet tablet cleanser. The problem was it sold out. So get it now before it sells out again. Blue Land's stunning high-quality forever bottles start at $10 when you buy the kit. And by the way, you really do save on the tablets because they don't have to ship all that water. They don't have to make the bottles. It's just $2. They start at $2. Try Blue Land today. You're going to love it. The planet will thank you. We've been very happy with Blue Land. We use it throughout the house. It just makes me feel good to know that we're not adding to all that plastic waste. It's way past time to make cleaning fun, beautiful, and plastic-free. Right now, you get 20% off your first order when you go to blueland.com/twit. 20% off your first order of any Blue Land products. My suggestion, get the sampler. Get them all. blueland.com/twit. You'll never go back. You'll say, this is it. We got Blue Land, blueland.com/twit. We thank them so much for supporting our holiday episodes of This Week in Tech. This was the year, not exactly, something to be proud of, but this was the year that the world's most famous internet meme hit 1 billion views. Rick Astley got his billion views. I am not going to Rickroll you. Fear not. But
remastered it in HD. It's wonderful.
So the official video for Rick Astley's 1987 hit, Never Gonna Give You Up, is now a 1 billion view video on YouTube because of Rickrolling, right? I don't think without Rickrolling there would be, in fact, any... But he's watching this video. And furthermore, in case you don't know, Rick Rolling is, of course, punking somebody by sending him a link to something they really want. And instead they get a video of Rick Astley, Never Gonna Give You Up, dancing like they danced those days. He's really young in that. He was very grateful, by the way. Did he know? When did he learn that he was that what Rick Rolling was? Because I'm sure.
I think it's when he got Rickrolled. Someone probably sent him his own video.
He is very grateful. His career obviously got a little kick in the butt.
All these parents explaining to their kids who he is. Yeah, exactly.
Here he is. Expressing his gratitude, Rick Astley. Let me go back.
So I've just been told that Never Gonna Give You Up has been streamed a billion times on YouTube. That is mind-blowing. The world is a wonderful and beautiful place, and I am very lucky.
And now you know why we use sound engineers when we record audio.
And we don't record on a lake.
What is he in a boat? What the hell is he? He's doing, he's on a boat.
He missed an opportunity to like start off saying they was thinking and then cut into the Rick.
He should have actually cut to it. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. 1 billion views. That's nothing. I mean,
Oppo Gangnam Style. Where are we now with Oppo Gangnam Style? There are many multi billion. It did, but there are many multi billion view. What is the most viewed YouTube video? I wonder. Let me see. I always think he kind of looks like you in this. By the way, Oppo Gangnam Style, Father Robert. I don't. I feel like it's kind of Father Robert singing this song.
I danced to this thing enough.
Yeah, God knows.
We had fun. We had a lot of fun with this. This song single-handedly, it proved the concept for the studio, for the Brick House, because there was so much entertainment that wasn't in the show.
Yeah, we
it
could
was
actually,
between the shows.
And you mastered that strange dance that he does where he's riding the horse. Okay. you actually were quite you were quite good at that. 4.1 billion views on Oppo Gangnam Style. But I don't think that's the top. I think there's 7 billion view songs now. So 1 billion isn't all that great. I suppose if I went
But okay, look, you know what? That song, Never Gonna Give You Up, it's actually a good song. It's an 80s song. I mean, it's a period piece.
It is.
It's not just a meme. It's not just a role.
Actually, I think Baby Shark might be the... most viewed. 9 billion views for Baby
Shark. Oh, my
Shark.
Goodness. Are you serious?
9 billion views.
Also Korean.
Also Korean. There's something going on. There's something in the water. Should we just play a little bit of that? Let's just play a little bit of that just to drive away all the
listeners. You'll get a copyright strike for sure.
Will you? If you play it?
Yeah. Actually, Ali Spagnola broke this down. She explained why that song is so addictive. It's because it ends on a minor chord. And anytime we hear that, we want resolution.
So you play it again.
You play it again, and it never happens.
Please,
so it's
Mommy, give me a major chord, please. I was completely blissfully unaware of this song until we were in Dubai a year ago. And, you know, in Dubai, they have the Burj Khalifa, the tallest building, was the tallest building in the world. And it has lights going up and down. And in front of it, they have a fountain display, kind of like in Vegas in front of the Bellagio where it fires. And they play music on the hour and they do the thing. So we're standing there waiting for the fountain display. And there it goes, Baby Shark. And I had never heard this song before. But you know what? It ended in a minor note, and that really bothered me.
I want the resolution.
Yeah, that actually makes
again sense. And again
I think
and
makes
again.
Sense. Big birthday this week. I love the Register. The Register is so good at headlines. Beige Against the Machine, the IBM PC, turns 40. 5150, not just a medical emergency. Also the beginning of the office brick. It was on August 12th, 1981. Big Blue released the first IBM PC. We didn't call it the 5150. We call it the PC. And it transformed an industry because up until then, there were lots of personal computers, Commodore and Atari and Apple, IMSI, MITS. All had made personal computers, but they were very hobbyist focused. When IBM arrived, it gave it a serious business cachet. And remember the full page ad that Steve Jobs took out in the Wall Street Journal saying from Apple, "Welcome, IBM." Seriously, they might have underestimated the impact IBM would have. Do you remember, Mike? The first PC when it came out, do you have a memory of that? Maybe you're not old enough.
I was not super paying attention at the point where that came out. It was more like the mid 80s when I started really getting into computers and stuff like that. But once in 1990, I started editing a computer magazine that very quickly became Windows Magazine. And that whole, magazine thing in the 90s was 100% a direct, that you can draw a direct line to this very event that you're talking about, the creation of the IBM Model 5150. And so, of course, we were always writing about the history, the ancient history of the, during the 80s of the IBM PC. And, it really, there are very few things that changed the course of technology the way this did. It could have gone in whole different directions, but because they use open components, because they had a reverse engineerable BIOS, because they idiotically went got in bed with Bill Gates.
That's a great story, by the way.
That set the tone for everything to happen for the next 20, 25 years. So. Yeah.
It was open. They chose off-the-shelf parts. The only thing that was proprietary was the BIOS. I don't think they designed it to be reverse engineerable, but it didn't take very long for Compaq and others, Phoenix and others, to say, oh, we can make a PC-compatible BIOS, which meant that within a year, Compaq was selling it compatible. It would run the same software, run the same operating. Oh, and that was the other smart thing. And the dumb thing that IBM did, they were looking for an operating system for the PC. They came out to Monterey, California, because DR-DOS was a very popular operating system in the CPM days. And Gary Kildall, who's the creator of DR-DOS, Digital Research, founder and president, was famously flying his private plane and declined to meet with IBM. So they flew up to Redmond, Washington, where there was another young upstart company, Microsoft, known for its BASIC, not for an operating system. They met with Bill Gates and said, we need an operating system for the PC. You got one? Bill said, yeah. He didn't. But he knew of a company called Seattle DOS, which had a DOS that would be compatible with IBM's 8088 chip, the chip that they were putting in there. It's an Intel chip. And he, without telling the owners of Seattle DOS, went across the street, said, I'd like to buy Seattle DOS. Didn't mention that there was another company interested, bought it for a song, and then turned around and sold it to IBM as PC DOS. The other thing that Gates did, it was probably the single biggest business move in history. He made a deal with IBM, and I don't know why IBM agreed to this, not to give it to them outright, not to sell it to them outright, but to retain the rights to it.
And he looked like he was 12 at the time.
Yeah, we got an offering system.
Yeah, I mean, but to me,
actually, that's funny because Seattle DOS came from Seattle Computer Products, which was staffed by high school students. So this, right. Remember, in the early days, this is in the early late 70s, early 80s. This was a hobbyist thing. Nobody was serious.
Exactly.
About this. Yeah.
I mean, he set the tone, I think, as a historian of Silicon Valley, he set the tone for the industry. So you had these well-meaning companies actually producing good products that were, you know, they were sort of relaxed about things. And then you have this bare knuckle, aggressive liar come along and just have this just hyper aggressive attack on IBM, saying that he had things he didn't have, and then a massive work ethic to go with it, willing to just do whatever it took. I mean, when he did the Altair BASIC, he lived in a trailer in a strip mall, and worked, he dropped out of Harvard and worked night and day to make that deal happen. It's not like he's lazy.
Oh God,
it's just a combination. It's just a combination of massive work ethic, lots of brains, no ethics,
and being a predatory businessman, basically.
Exactly. And that set the tone for the Silicon Valley we know and love today.
He bought PC DOS from Seattle Computer Products for $25,000. Like, the same month that IBM came to him and he didn't have anything, just prior to the launch of the PC on the August 12th, on July 27th, he went to Seattle DOS and said, I'll give you another $50,000 for full rights. And they didn't know anything about the PC. They said, okay. So for $75,000, he bought an operating system, which basically made Microsoft. And then he made a deal with IBM saying, well, we'll keep the rights. We'll just license this to you. And I don't know why IBM agreed to it, but what it made possible is the compatibles, because then he was able to sell MS-DOS to Compaq and all these other makers of PC compatibles, and it made it completely 100% IBM PC compatible, which was good for us. Apple went
through, right, exactly. But this is the thing that, among the hobbyist market, software was just nothing and hardware was everything. They would, the hobbyists, like, the Chaos Computer Club that Steve Wozniak was part of, they would just write software and hand it around and it was free. It was no big deal. And then the computers were the thing that
right.
monetary value. And Bill Gates had the vision to understand, no, whoever owns the software has all the power.
Don Estridge, a Skunk Works project out in Boca Raton. IBM is up in Armonk, New York. up your way, Tim. Not quite so far north.
Not too far away.
But not too far away. So they said, look, you know, we're known for mainframes. Let's send a small team of engineers down to Boca Raton, and they're going to design something. What was the code name for the original IBM PC? I'm trying to remember. Had a good code name. Project Chess, according, but I don't know if that was the code name for the original PC. Anyway, they designed it. You may remember the, do you remember the ads for the IBM PC?
Acorn was the...
Acorn, yeah.
Coding.
Yep, thank you. Charlie Chaplin, remember these for the first... Let me see if I can find one.
Yeah, they're beautiful ads. You know, while you're finding that, it's interesting that the low-end model of the IBM PC had 16 kilobytes.
Kilobytes, not megabytes.
I just bought an iPad that has 16 gigabytes.
I know. Of RAM. I know, and some consider that low. Charlie Chaplin with some of the original IBM PC ads. They were going after business. It didn't. The base model, which was $1,500, did not have floppy disks or a hard drive. Heaven forfend. It had a cassette interface, and you would save your programs and your files out to cassette. They did offer, if you were willing to spend more, you could configure it all the way up to $5,000. You could get dual floppies, no hard drive. There it is with the dual floppies, that big old CRT. You could either get it in color, kind of a hideous, I can't remember how many colors it had, 256 colors, or you could get it monochrome, green on black.
The IBM personal computer. Try one on at a store near you.
Yeah.
Wow.
1981. 40 years ago. It's not that long, really.
No.
Nope. But boy, the world has changed thanks to that.
Yeah, so it's pretty much has changed since then.
Yeah.
Here's some interesting alternative history. Gary Kildall, who started digital research in the Monterey area near where Tim's staying, says in his unpublished memoir, which is actually available via the Computer History Museum, that he and Bill Gates had talked about merging their companies.
Oh.
And in which case Microsoft, which at the time was in Albuquerque, New Mexico, would have moved to Pacific Grove.
Oh, that would have been wonderful.
Mm. That would have been a very different history of Silicon Valley.
I used to live on Lover's Seattle. Point in Pacific Grove. I love that area.
But Kildall thought that he called Bill Gates opinionated,
yeah,
and was always uneasy around him.
Yeah, so, and by the way, I think he has said that that's apocryphal that he was flying around in an airplane. Maybe that's an urban legend, but it's a great urban legend.
Yeah. Yeah.
For whatever reason, IBM didn't do a deal with him and went to a company that did not, in fact, have a PC DOS and bought it from them.
Bill Gates didn't even have a tie when he went to the meeting, and he had to borrow one. Or
is
something.
That true? Oh, wow. Oh, that's
yeah, there's
hysterical.
Some story like that where he had to bought one in the airport or something like that.
I'm going to see if I can find. I love these old. I don't know. Maybe because I'm an old timer, I just love these. Here's the Welcome Seriously ad, I think. Let me see if I can find it here. It was in the Wall Street Journal. Cleverly positioning the upcoming battle as a two-way contest between the spunky and rebellious Apple and the establishment Goliath. Yeah, here's an image of it from Inc.com. Welcome, IBM. Seriously. Welcome to the most exciting and most important marketplace since the computer revolution began 35 years ago. And congratulations on your first personal computer. When we invented the first personal computer system, maybe a little hyperbole on that, we estimated that over 140 million people worldwide could justify the purchase of one if they only understood its benefits. Next year alone, we project that well over 1 million will come to that understanding. 1 million people. Wow. Little did he know what IBM was going to do and just kind of dominate the space. And to this day, still, PCs dominate. Not,
so
Apple's
IBM
not even close.
Is, of course, completely out of that business.
Yeah. No, they don't do it anymore. Yeah. Although they do have a 2-nanometer chip, so good. They're not sitting on the resting on their laurels. Base price for a 5150, $1,565. Fully loaded system, more than $3,000. You could have monochrome or CGA. That was the one. And CGA did not have many colors at all. 16 or 64 kilobytes of RAM. The processor, an Intel 88, chugging along at, and I do remember this, 4.77 megahertz. Mega.
Blistering
speeds. Megahertz.
So did Apple have the last laugh? They're still in the personal computer business 40 years on.
Yeah, they beat IBM.
Yeah.
If anything, IBM's mistake was making it so easy to clone. But if you're talking about the platform, that's why they were so successful. You could clone a PC. And so there are thousands of people to this day making what is essentially an IBM PC compatible still.
And Microsoft even makes them.
That's right. That's a good point. Happy birthday. 40 years ago, August 12th, the IBM PC was born. Carl Bode. It's Bode, right?
Yeah. Yep.
Not Tom Baudet. Carl Bode wrote an article saying, this is great news. More communities are building their own broadband. Why? Because of COVID? How is that happening?
Well, you know, most people don't like their regional telecom giant, whether it's, you know, Comcast or whoever it is, you know, and most people only have the choice.
It's a monopoly.
83 million Americans live under a broadband monopoly. You know, here in Seattle, which is, you know, Silicon Valley North, I have the choice of one provider, Comcast.
Isn't that terrible? It's awful. You know?
And this has been going on for 25 years, literally. We've thrown billions and billions and billions of dollars at this problem. And it just, so I think a lot of these local towns and cities have just gotten incredibly frustrated. So there's about 1,000 different communities that have, in the last decade or two, built their own broadband access that routinely winds up being cheaper, faster, more reliable. The money that the locals spend on this service goes back into the community. The people who work for these providers tend to live in the communities they serve. So unlike a lot of these regional monopolies, the money is staying there and they're more accountable to the locals. So
I'm surprised because I know that when Philadelphia tried this, that they were immediately sued and state legislatures across the country started passing bills prohibiting municipal broadband. But this is despite those bills.
Yeah, there's 17 states that currently have passed laws restricting towns and cities from getting into the broadband business or building their own broadband networks or expanding those networks. But I think COVID really showcased when you saw toddlers like sitting on the sidewalk outside of Taco McDonald's. Bell to try and get online for class. You know, this has always been a problem, but COVID really accelerated, you know, the awareness. So it really has driven some action.
Good. And so those 17 states, forget it.
It depends. Each state has a different variation. Sometimes it'll be an outright ban on building your own local network, and sometimes it'll be worded in a very convoluted way to make it as difficult as possible to raise funds or to expand, or you can't market in this zone, or you can only, if it's like, a lot of these networks are built on the back of the local power utility. And so what
Chattanooga did that,
same.
Right?
Yeah. One of the fastest and cheapest fiber providers in the nation.
They have gigabit. Yeah.
But what a law will sometimes do is say you can't expand this network outside of the local utility footprint. You know, some of the laws will say something like that. And there's no real reason for it outside of the fact that the regional telecom monopolies, who literally ghostwrite most of these laws, just told the state representatives that they didn't want that to happen. And this stuff is super popular. It's bipartisan. There's no excuse for the failure that I've seen in the last 20 years.
The ideological argument is that, well, you wouldn't want government to compete with private industry.
Yeah, but the counter argument is that, you know, a lot of these companies have had 20 years to wire these areas and they don't want to because the return on their investment is low. But at the same time, they don't want anybody else building their own broadband networks because they might want to go back someday.
Yeah, we may someday. You know, yeah.
It's a very cake and eat it too kind of thing for these companies.
Oh, what a surprise.
Thinking about when I ran for Congress, I got to know so much about local budgeting, like more than I ever would have thought. And I'd like here in Dedham, where, you know, a friend of the show, Paul Thoreau, used to live here too.
Right.
We canceled our trail this year, like a just walking trail, because COVID has destroyed our municipal budget. If you go over to poor areas of Massachusetts, like Brockton, I can promise you the Brockton tax base is not, you know, going to like go for a bunch of broadband development right now. So yeah. I'm for you. I'm with you in principle, but I'm also thinking about the people that need it most and thinking about towns like Whitman, where they're like, hey, we're just going to have our library open for 3 days a week because we have no money. You know, we're going to have a 4 day a week police department. And, I'm thinking about like, is it really a feasible thing all through the United States? Like COVID is going to affect our local revenues for years.
Yeah, it's not like a silver bullet where you could just do this in every nation. And there's also like multiple varieties of different types of ISPs that are built out of this model. You know, some will be on the back of the local power utility that won't use taxpayer money at all. Some will be a private public partnership that, you know, just works with a local provider like Google Fiber or somebody to deploy to the area. So it's not all just tax-based driven models. I mean, there's a wide variety of models they can explore.
Here in this little town of Petaluma, about 60,000 people, there was a big initiative about 5 years ago to put in community Wi-Fi. Initially, Comcast was going to help, but then they bowed out. Then another provider was going to help. They bowed out. They put some stuff up, but it didn't work. It's gone. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think it's just a hard thing to do. And there isn't a lot of support from the incumbents, of course. So you really have to have a leader, a civic leader who's going to really push it through.
Yeah, it's like any, you know, I mean, one of the things the telecom companies will do is they'll just say that these are automatic taxpayer boondoggles and you should never try it. But I mean, they're just like any other business plan and they require a good leader and a sound plan. And you know, look at Chattanooga that built its own fiber network when Comcast refused to. They've been ranked consistently one of the most affordable, fastest internet providers in the country.
Well, the other good reason to do it is evidence shows everywhere that incumbents were challenged by fiber, whether it was Google Fiber or others, that prices went down, that, you know, speeds went up. And even in some communities where there's fiber up to this road, you could see the prices go up as soon as the fiber from the other company is not available. It's like no competition. Great. We're going to raise the prices. It's
and the thing that's frustrating is like, you know, the approach to ban these entirely. We've spent literally about 25 years where the U.S., ever since we broke up Ma Bell, the U.S. telecom policy has basically been to do whatever the dominant regional monopolies want. I mean, with some exceptions occasionally. You know, like net neutrality was an effort to say, okay, maybe we should apply some very basic rules to these companies. And anytime anybody tries to do that, the companies get Congress to freak out. You know, trying something different will destroy the internet. You know, that's basically their line.
But the good news is we live in this great country. We have the best internet in the world, right?
Incorrect. I'm afraid we rank pretty much mediocre on every metric that matters, whether you're looking at
the country that invented the internet, 14th place globally in speed.
Yeah. We're both 14th in fixed line broadband and 14th in wireless. And I think
at least we're consistent.
We actually got a little worse in fixed line broadband despite a lot of fiber.
So. Wow, we're slower than Canada, Italy, Saudi Arabia. The argument I hear when I mention this is, well, those countries have federally supported or federally owned, government-owned internet companies or telecom companies. Is that always the case?
No, I don't think Canada has too many of those. I mean,
Canada's got the worst that's funny because Canada's got the worst telecom companies. Rogers.
Yeah, they're very similar. They're very similar to us. They're regional monopolies that have been allowed to write laws for literally 20 years. And then people stand around with a silly look on their face wondering why things are spotty and expensive and slow.
Okay.
Well, I really support just anything. It seems logical to allow these little niche solutions to thrive so that we can have any kind of creative solution.
Yes.
100%. It's
common sense.
And hey, at least we may only be 14th in terms of speed, but we are the least expensive, right, Carl?
No, pretty much one of the most expensive countries for both wireless and wired.
You're telling me we pay more and get less?
Yeah, and then there's that customer service, which is
God, well-loved. I love them. I saw a survey once. People would rather have a heart attack than call Comcast customer service.
These companies are literally, Yeah, these companies are literally ranked worst in customer satisfaction and service than pretty much any industry in America. And when you think about the fact that that includes banks, that includes insurance, that includes airlines, I mean, that's a feat. And it's been pretty consistent. There's been some minor improvements from some of these companies in the last few years, but it's not great.
I think we're still in 14th place. In fact, maybe we're in 15th place. I don't know. I don't think it's gotten much better. All right. We're going to wrap it up with a look at the 20th anniversary of the iPod and big changes in China. But first, I want to talk to you about the food box we got the other day. Okay. You've probably heard about imperfect foods. And I'm sure, like me, you thought, well, they're going to be really, you know, imperfect. They're not. They're great. This is the best food box I've ever received. How about this for a 3-in-1 New Year resolution? Let's reduce food waste, let's save time on grocery shopping, and let's eat more fresh and delicious food. That's imperfect foods. Here's you really want to feel bad, a cringeworthy stat to start the year. Every year, 35% of the food supply in this country goes unsold or uneaten. Wasted. 35%. This is food in the grocery store shelves that gets thrown out because nobody bought it. Imperfect Foods is working to turn this around, and I'm really happy to be part of this as a customer, by sourcing foods that would otherwise fall through the cracks of our food system. Not imperfect foods, just foods that are not going to be sold because they're too small, right? Or they're the kind of avocado that bruises easily, doesn't look good on the shelf. But they're great. When I get them home, they look great, and I'm so happy to have them. I know, you know, we all want to combat climate change, but that feels like, what can we do? What can one person do? This is a great way to make an impact. It's just, let's eliminate some waste. Imperfect foods. Let me explain what it is. I suppose I should explain. We get a box every Thursday. You get a different day, I'm sure, but this is when we get ours every Thursday. The box, it's a grocery delivery service. It's not just vegetables. It's everything. An entire line of sustainable groceries. They taste delicious. They reduce waste. And they save you time because they come to you. And all you have to do is accept that it's not going to be perfect, except it is. It's perfect. Go to imperfectfoods.com. See if they deliver in your area. If they don't, I'm sorry. I really am. I'm so thrilled they do here. Once you sign up, you personalize your weekly grocery order with fresh seasonal produce. You can actually get, there's pantry staples, yummy snacks, and, you know, really a lot of the stuff you would just go shop for anyway. Plus, your order arrives you get to choose on the same day every week, so you can just make this part of your stress-free routine. On Thursdays, that's my job. The Imperfect Foods box arrives. I put it in the fridge. I unpack it. I have to say, again, not imperfect. Perfect. Really looks good. On average, and you can feel good about this, because on average, Imperfect Food customers save 6 to 8 pounds of food with every order, food that would not be sold otherwise, and it's great. Unlike on-demand delivery companies, Imperfect delivers weekly by neighborhood, so that's reducing emissions. That's another goal of theirs: 25 to 75% fewer emissions than you drive into the grocery store. It was on the way; they dropped it off on the way, and they consolidate it. So that's why we have Thursday. Your day will be different, probably. You can also say, and this is a big thing for me, say goodbye to packaging guilt. They're the only national grocery delivery company that makes it easy to return your packaging after every order. They also use minimum packaging. So instead of a plastic bag full of oranges, then a plastic bag full of grapefruit and a plastic bag full of apples, they're just in there. And I'm telling you, again, perfect. Okay, maybe it's a little smaller than you'd see in the grocery store, right? We got artichokes. They're a little smaller. So the grocery store won't stock them. I want them. They're great. They're better, frankly. Zucchini, broccoli. I've never had a fresher head of broccoli in my life. It was incredible. So I'm sincere in saying I highly recommend you try this. Right now, Imperfect Foods is offering you 20% off your first four orders. Your first four orders when you go to imperfectfoods.com, use the promo code TWIT, please. 20% off your first four orders. That's like up to $80 off. Imperfectfoods.com. They're beautiful. Imperfectfoods.com. I don't care if my, you know, my squash has Nixon's nose on it. I don't care. Imperfectfoods.com. When you use the promo code TWIT, join the movement. $80 value, 20% off your first four orders. And you're just going to feel great about it. I love it that two of our sponsors this week are making a difference in the environment. I just think that's so great. And I think I can probably thank my wife for that because she really cares about this stuff. Imperfectfoods.com, promo code TWIT. She also cares about the best produce, the freshest produce, and we get it from Imperfect Foods. We're super happy. Imperfectfoods.com, promo code TWIT. Thank you, Imperfect Foods. You're perfect. China's central bank. Hey, China has been, clamping down on a lot of digital stuff, including the latest, well, when we did this show, cryptocurrency. Boy, did we have a good panel that day. Listen, I'm going to give you a chance. China, think of all the things China has been able to do. They've been able to shut down and curtail this, you know, the ultra growth in some of their more consumer focused technologies. They get kids to only video game 3 hours a week through Monday, on Saturday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and holidays. Now they have said all cryptocurrency related activities are illegal. Gee, wouldn't it be nice if we had a totalitarian government and we could just come on in and say, Facebook, this is going to be fixed.
It would stop the Winklevoss twins, I'll tell you that.
we talk about, and obviously I'm a little bit tongue in cheek, so you don't have to come down too hard on it. But it is interesting that they're doing a lot of the things that people say here in the United States. Gee, we should.
Well, you know, exactly. Beware. We can see where it goes. It goes toward China. I've been screaming that for years. So you're right. Some would like that level of authoritarianism. But that ain't my country.
Yeah. I think Jen, you probably follow this fairly closely, given your interest in Asia. The question that I've heard a lot of people say is this because the CCP has decided to focus more on infrastructure technology and infrastructure and less on consumer technology?
I don't know. I think there's a case that a couple of things are going on, including the regime's incredible zeal to be a dictatorship and to clamp down and control everything.
A free and vibrant consumer technology sector is not helpful to that.
Yeah, what's been amazing to see. I'm sorry, did it, Dan? Did I step on you? Finish up.
Well, there was just one other thing. On the clampdown on cryptocurrencies, I'm not sure that there's, let me reverse it. I think there's probably another motive there in addition to just general control freakery and related to that, because the economy and in particular real estate is grossly overheated in China, and mm-hmm. they're in a major bubble on property values and have totally overbuilt and have had companies that are wildly over leveraged, owing, you know, hundreds of billions. And it may be that in banning cryptocurrencies, they're trying to control or at least slow down the flight of capital that tends to happen from countries that are perhaps heading toward economic really serious trouble. And, of course, the whole world would be caught in that if it does happen. But that seemed pretty plausible to me. And I don't remember where I read that, but that struck a chord as maybe that is part of the motivation to just prevent too much money from fleeing the country.
But isn't it more cultural than that too? Isn't it a matter of control and If the regime could stay popular by everybody getting more money and growing and having bigger homes and buying more stuff, fine for as long as that lasted. But then when trouble comes, they have to put the hammer down, and we're almost headed to an economic cultural revolution. Is that going overboard?
No, that makes sense. And I think these are intertwined. If we're looking for some specific thing, because I thought this cryptocurrency ban was very sudden, and I had not, there were some things that happened that were perhaps in retrospect leading up to it. But this is a surprise to me. And you know, when we look in our own country and other countries about cryptocurrencies, man, I think people who are speculating in those areas who are not the insiders who are already profited and will stand to profit even more, be careful.
Yep. Yeah, I think there's a couple things going on. You know, these are great points about, you know, these real estate companies. The people say this could be another subprime that affects the rest of the world. But in the last year, I've been really surprised to see how hard China is coming down against the entrepreneurs like Jack Ma, who were once celebrated as, you know, successes of the whole Chinese system. So it's almost reminiscent of what Putin did to slam down the oligarchs in Russia. And so maybe that's not the greatest way to build a global internet business, to, you know, take your most gloried entrepreneurs and founders and charge them with crimes or, you know, remove them. I think certainly it shows that the control that China shows, it just can't be trusted as a global brand. And you see, obviously, we don't trust Huawei, and TikTok is, you know, was sort of teetering in the Trump era, but now it's still the most popular download among social network apps.
More engagement than YouTube, longer viewing times. Yeah.
So but I would say that stands as an anomaly before the curtains come down on big private internet in China.
Well, they were the only company. All these companies that are so popular and so universal and necessary in China that didn't break the border. I mean, isn't TikTok the only company that really did?
Yeah.
And it only did so by acquisition.
Some people said that was going to be the dawn of this new era. But then you see what happened with Alibaba, and Didi now is under, you know, great pressure, and China's clamped down on them. You know, the huge success, the company that beat Uber, right? And it's not just in China, but they're the main presence and ride sharing in some other countries. So it's really interesting to see how what looked like China's participation in a global internet by nurturing these companies has done a 180.
China was even cracking down on WeChat. You were talking about these Chinese-only companies that are completely dominant in China. I don't know what the status is today, but last July, WeChat had to stop signing people up.
Yeah. There's another aspect to the clampdown on the social media type companies, is that the China regime is basically saying, you know, companies, corporations, you may not spy on everybody. We will.
That's our job.
The government. It's our job.
Right.
And
right.
You know, you'll help us. But when it comes to who really is in control, it's us. And don't forget that.
I wonder if that's a subtext of the American government crackdown.
Yep. I think so.
Yeah. I do have one thing to say about this rule that the kids can only play video games for like 3 hours a week. If these kids have not managed to figure out how to hack their way past that, then China really is dead.
Maybe they're trying to create a hacker class. That's probably one good way to do it. Teach kids how to get around the government crackdown. That's got to hurt. 3 hours a week. Wow. 20 years ago today, Steve Jobs taught the band to play, put a thousand songs in our pocket. And Connie, you were at that event.
I was. It was a notable day, not just because Steve Jobs was really good at doing presentations and keeping the audience enthralled, but because it was such a big risk for Apple. At the time, it was primarily known as the maker of the Macintosh. And it was 2001, so Jobs had been back 5 years, and they were still, you know, in financial struggles. They had had the new candy-colored iMacs before, but they still, you know, weren't, you know, solvent, I would say. They were still struggling to make money. So for them to take a risk on the consumer electronics market was a big move. And Jobs started out his pitch that day with an emotional appeal, which was, everybody's into music. This is a market that's never going to go away. People love music. We love music. And you should do what you love. And he really did a good job of keeping the audience, you know, following along with him and his logic. There were other music players on the market. Apple is typically not the first into a new space, but he sold them on how it was going to be. Apple was going to make it elegant and easy and really fast to upload music to this, you know, very cool looking device. I mean, I have to admit, this is my original iPod I got it that day. It's in pretty good shape, not because Apple gave away a case. I actually asked Jobs about that. I said, have you thought about making cases? And he said, what for? It fits in your pocket. And I was wearing a skirt with no pockets. And I'm like, because some of us carry stuff in our bags. So I went home and I sewed my own little case. I found it.
Oh, it's a little cow. It's a gateway case.
With yarn from my kids, you know, plaything. And that's what's kept this thing in pristine condition. But wow. It was a notable moment. Like I said, it was a risk. It took a while for the iPod to be a success. I don't think people realized that. It was not an instant hit. It took them 4 or 5 years to really sell in the millions of devices. But by then, they'd introduced the iTunes Store and had taken on the music labels, as all of us recall. It was one of Steve Jobs' famous open letters to the industry and talking about why you should be able to buy songs individually rather than buying a whole CD. And it was just cool, right? The Silhouette ads, they had a U2 iPod. Bono was there for the launch of that. I actually got to meet Bono on the Edge day. Very cool. And there was a lot of good marketing hype. And of course, 1,000 songs in your pocket was quite a great tagline. So it was.
We still remember it. And of course, it's like trivial to put 1,000 songs in your pocket now. What is on your iPod? Do you have the original music still on there?
I do. Jobs gave away 20 albums. And so everybody in the audience had to go home with a shopping bag with all the CDs. Otherwise, it would have been music piracy, right?
There's you're kidding.
To get them. So I have all 20. And I wrote a story about it on CNET. You can see a photo. But there were a couple of Beatles, Hard Day's Night, Abbey Road. There was two Simon and Garfunkel. This is Steve Jobs' playlist. And so CNET put together a Spotify playlist if you want to hear it all. Yo-Yo Ma, Glenn Gould, B.B. King, of course, Bob Dylan. You know, Jobs is into Dylan. Sarah McLachlan was the first bit of music played. And the thing that I remember about that event, aside from people going, well, that's kind of cool. Yeah, they had FireWire, which was their fast file transfer standard. I still have the FireWire cable.
Yeah, you and I both, in order to charge it, we had to find FireWire. And the FireWire official Apple FireWire charging brick. Wow.
It was fast watching him load music off of his... He had a Mac, you know, computer on.
You had to connect it. You had to rip the CDs... And then into iTunes, and then you had to connect it to your computer, and then you had to copy it over, synchronize it over, and it was carefully done so that you couldn't easily steal the songs later.
But it was also auto-sync, which was very cool. Right. You could rip a lot of music, and if you ripped 10 CDs on Tuesday, and then you went back on Friday and you ripped others, it knew that... you know, what to sync up was, which is something that we take for granted now. But that was a big deal in those days, honestly. And Yeah, it was the start of Apple moving into this consumer electronics space. And it was cemented in 2007, obviously, when they introduced the iPhone. A lot of people don't maybe not remember this, but on the day they introduced the iPhone, so we've had the iPod and all the iterations. The iPhone kind of subsumes the iPod, right? Because the iPhone is a phone and it's a music player as well. And that was the day that Jobs changed the name of the company from Apple Computer Inc. to Apple Inc. in recognition
that they were no longer a
computer company.
Oh.
Yeah, on the day they introduced the iPhone, not the iPod.
Oh, yeah, the iPhone, yeah.
Yeah, so it was the start of that whole path. And, of course, $2 trillion valuation later, it was obviously the right call.
Yeah, this was before the iPhone. This was the most successful consumer product of all time, I think. I mean, it really was dominant.
I have one story that I want to tell, and that is, and no disrespect to Microsoft here, but at some point, I was speaking at an event, and someone gave me a Zune. And I still have the Zune. It still powers up. But I came home, and I had two kids, and I gave my daughter iPod to use. And I gave my son the Zune.
Did he say, why do you hate me, Mom?
He did. Do you love Laura better than you love me? So
you can have a Zune.
Of course, we got him an iPod after that. So a Shuffle, by the way. That was the years of the iPod Shuffle, even smaller with more capacity.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah.
How many iPods? I mean, we all have owned probably most of them. I even bought my sister the U2, the black and red U2 iPod. It was loaded with U2 albums. Come to think of it, there's been a long heritage of love between Apple and Bono for some reason. I'm not sure I really understand that.
Well, it wasn't just the U2.
Everybody loves Bono. Yeah.
It wasn't just the U2 iPod. It was the first time that Bono and U2 had licensed their music digitally.
Right.
They own,
big deal.
Unlike a lot of musicians, they own their catalog.
Right.
So that's why it was a big deal.
That was a big deal, getting them to say, okay, you can sell it digitally. Remember, God, people, it's moved so fast. You forget, bands did not allow digital copies of their music. They were terrified by the whole thing.
Napster, boy. Yeah. LimeWire.
Yeah. This was
good old
the
days.
Other thing that... this was a early MP3 player. This was for a car, obviously. But this has
a laser disc? Was that 8-track?
It had a hard drive in it. This is a Rio. This is a Rio. Exactly. Yeah. And I had the little small portable Rio as well, the Diamond Rio that was predated the iPod. But the thing that all of these did wrong, we even did many shows on the screensavers about building your own. Put a computer in your trunk. And have MP3s on a hard drive. But the thing that was hard about all these is navigation. It was miserable. Finding your music and playing it was miserable. And it was a brilliant insight Tony Fadell came up with, the designer of the iPod, to have that click wheel. These actually are sold. They actually turn. But they held up.
That click sound is one of the things you could just like play and...
You know,
it's like
people
the
know
AOL
it.
Dial up. You know
yeah,
exactly.
People
what
know
is.
It. Yeah, a lot of Britney Spears on this one. I'm just going to say it must have been my daughter's,
or she was the last one to have it.
I'm going to defend the Zune. The first Brown Zune, not great, but at the end of the Zune HD was actually a really good music device, and I was kind of sad that Microsoft, having finally perfected that device, gave up on it.
By the time it got good, they had already lost.
Yeah, I guess that's what it was. You couldn't. There was too much headwind.
Yeah, it's funny. There's actually a huge following. If you go check out Reddit, there's a huge following. People still love that device.
The HD. Yeah,
yeah.
I think that was in every respect. It was kind of the Windows Phone of music players because it had a great interface. It had a big screen. It was kind of in every way superior to the competition, but it was too late, just like the Windows Phone. It was over. You know, I was kind of sad about that. It was shortly after Microsoft gave up its music. You could used to be able to buy music from Microsoft and all of that, and they gave up all of that. Hard to believe, 20 years ago. And does your son still think you like your daughter better?
No, he has. We've bought him iPhone, so
yeah, yeah, he's okay now. He's okay.
He's been redeemed.
He's okay. Yeah, yeah, that's good. Hard to believe 20 years ago, the iPod, and I still have it right here, the original, as I showed on that episode. What a great, fun time this has been. I really love going back through time with you, through the year 2021. only surpassed in weirdness by 2020. Another wonderful year in the books. We're going to see if 2022 can be any better, but we are going to immediately start collecting best of segments because it's always a lot of fun. Thank you so much for joining me. Again, next week, we look ahead. We look to the future with a futurist, a sci-fi author, and a scientist. It's going to be very, very exciting stuff. I think you're going to enjoy it. And I just want to thank you so much for your support all year long. A special tip of the ho-ho-ho hat to our Club Twit members. Almost 4,000 of you now. We started it this year. We didn't know, you know, if you'd be interested, people would like it. But I'm so glad you do. Thank you to our members. Ad-free versions of all of our shows. That great Discord channel. It's so much fun. And, of course, the Twit Plus feed featuring shows that are not on the network. That are only for Club Twit, like our Untitled Linux show, Stacey Higginbotham's Book Club. We've got some great ones coming up. Mike Elgin and his wife Amira, we're going to talk about the Gastronomad Adventures coming up. I think Jeff Jarvis is going to do an Ask Me Anything. Lisa and I will do another Inside Twit. All of that available exclusively to members. Simply go to twit.tv/clubtwit. $7 a month. I think it's worth it, and it sure helps us out. Smooths out the dips in the economy, so as it were, keeps the podcast flowing. Thank you, everybody. We'll do Twit again live, as I said, that special edition next week, as we do every Sunday, 2:30 Pacific, 5:30 Eastern, 22:30 UTC. You can watch us do it live at live.twit.tv. You can chat in our great chat room, open to all, irc.twit.tv, or for Club Twit members in our Discord. And of course, after the fact, on-demand versions of this and all of our shows available at the website, twit.tv. There's a dedicated YouTube channel for This Week in Tech. Subscribe, though, because that way you get it automatically the minute it's available. And we thank you all so much for listening. Have a happy new year. I'll see you next week for a look into the future with Twit. Another Twit this is in the can. Another year.
Doing the Twit. Thank you.